Hi everyone, welcome to Live Longer World, a podcast where we unite to boost longevity and fight aging. I am your host, Aastha Jain, and I am so thrilled to be bringing this information to you today. If you wish to support this podcast, you can do so by signing up as a premium member and receive transcripts of each episode. You can find more information at livelongerworld.com/premium. To find all previous podcast episodes, my newsletter posts, and other resources, you can head over to my website, livelongerworld.com. With that, let's get started with today's episode. Hi, Dr. Weiss, and welcome to the Live Longer World podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you because, you know, as I started looking into understanding heart disease risk better and some of the markers around, say, cholesterol and lipids, there's just so much information that's floated around on the web, whereas understanding some of these are a lot more nuanced than what's common knowledge. So I'm quite excited to learn from you. And I want to begin by talking about three misconceptions that you've mentioned before that people have around heart disease. The first one being that people think that heart disease only occurs in those who are overweight or smoke. Second one being that people think if they take good care of themselves, they cannot have heart disease. And then lastly, people think heart disease cannot occur in young people. And I want to talk more specifically maybe about the last two misconceptions also because I know you got fascinated by this field when you saw a lot of, say, people in their 30s or early 40s who were getting heart disease, but they had no obvious risk for it. So I'm sure it also varies by person and a lot of it is genetic, but what is happening in these young people who have no obvious risk for heart disease or are living healthy lifestyles?
It's an amazing question. The short answer is there's no answer. I think, you know, there are some people, there are some predictors that I think are demonstrated to confer risk. And so when you do see this disease show up in young people, and when, to me, well, especially now, but even normally, young to me is anything less than 40, right? No mm-hmm. one less than 40 should be having coronary artery disease. So when you right. when that does show up, I think we, you know, sort of, there are some common things you look for. The most obvious of those is, you know, some significant lipid abnormality, right? So elevations in some cholesterol. But there are people who have disease at a young age like that and have normal looking cholesterol, and every other risk factor looks normal. So, and that's still a big puzzle. We don't have an answer to why that is.
Are most of those cases genetic?
I mean, that's the assumption that we always make. It's actually sort of ironic. It's how I got involved in cardiovascular research in the first place, and how I ended up deciding to be a cardiologist was I got involved with a study, and the study design was very simple. It took people like that, young people who showed up with a heart attack or something like a heart attack at a young age, and then went and very carefully tried to analyze their siblings, their first degree, their siblings. So it was a study not of the proband of the people with the disease, but a study of the people related to people who had early disease to see if anything could pop up. That was called the sibling study, and I think it's still ongoing, but it was an interesting effort to try and understand some of this connection. We always just fall back on genetics being the cause, and, you know, likely is a major cause, but probably also not all of it.
Do you think then, do you have a hypothesis that maybe there are other risk factors that we should be testing that we don't test for, that are not the obvious ones for heart disease, but perhaps they could be telling in our predictors of heart disease in some of these people?
Well, I guess to answer your question, there are different factors that we measure today than we did when I started medical school 30 years ago. So, you know, at that time, you basically would measure, well, the traditional risk factors that came out of the Framingham study were the things that we all know, right? So cholesterol, I think at the time, even then, they were making a distinction between the different fractions of cholesterol, HDL and LDL. Presence or absence of diabetes, presence or absence of smoking cigarettes, Let's see what else is on that one. You'd think I would know these by heart. Obviously, presence or absence of a history of disease in the vasculature. I'm drawing a blank on what else is in there, but those are the basic ones. I think since then we've evolved now to get a little bit more sophisticated and look at lipids themselves. So not just say total cholesterol, but we'll look at the fractions, and now not just LDL, but we'll look at ApoB or non-HDL cholesterol, which seems to be more predictive. I think we have a better understanding of HDL cholesterol and its role in disease. We've got an appreciation of this other related molecule called Lp(a), lipoprotein(a), which I think is something that, you know, was certainly not anything we looked at back then. And then the other thing that sort of happened in the past 20, 25 years is the role of inflammation. So we measure inflammatory biomarkers, I think, that are also predictive of future risk.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, so I definitely want to dive into all those nuances. But before that, I had one question then. What sort of genetic screens or checks should a person get to test for their genetic risk for heart disease?
Honestly, today, none. I think the if you had, I mean, there are some edge cases where, you know, genetic testing can be helpful. So the best example of those is probably familial hypercholesterolemia. So if there were some reason to suspect FH, then there are panels now of commercially available simple, genetic tests to look for FH. It doesn't obviously cover everything. It just covers what we know, but those are pretty useful. Those are probably the only ones that are sort of ready for prime time and, the only ones I kind of use in any regularity.
I see. Okay. So you mentioned a lot of, like say cholesterol, or now some of the tests have become a lot more nuanced where you look at ApoB or lipoprotein(a). Maybe before that though, you can talk a little bit about just LDL versus HDL. It's still commonly viewed that LDL is this bad cholesterol, HDL is the good one. Is that a misconception? Or is that true? How do you think about it?
I guess I'll back up. When I was a student, we referred to LDL as bad cholesterol, HDL as good cholesterol. We sort of ignored triglycerides, and we didn't really get any more detailed than that. I think it is still true that LDL is bad cholesterol. I think we've gotten a little bit more sophisticated in how we can measure it. And, you know, the measurement of LDL was never really very good, right? We hardly ever measured it directly. It was mostly calculated from a formula based on, you know, sort of getting rid of everything else. So taking the total cholesterol and subtracting out the other fractions. But it is still, I think, very clearly bad. I think it's been now validated to be bad in multiple different lines of evidence, right? It's, epidemiology, which is how we got here in the first place. I think there are, you know, animal models that support it. The genetics are incredibly compelling, right? So that rare and common variation in genes that affect LDL cholesterol affect risk in both directions. So things that lower LDL cholesterol reduce risk, things that increase it, increase risk. And those are predictable, right? So the magnitude of change in LDL driven by these, you know, genetic factors impacts the risk in a very predictable and linear way. So I think, you know, that's probably, and then there's the whole world of randomized controlled drug trials, which I think also, you know, have been very highly supportive to confirm the LDL hypothesis, right? That LDL cholesterol is bad. HDL cholesterol is really interesting because HDL cholesterol is clearly associated, so higher levels of HDL cholesterol are associated with reduced risk. That's something that I learned as a student. And so that's why HDL was named good cholesterol. And I think what we've learned now in the intervening 25 years is that it's not clear that HDL itself is actually driving risk, that HDL is certainly a marker of risk. So it is true that high HDL is a marker of lower risk, and lower HDL is a marker of higher risk. That can be used to predict risk in a model, either individually or in a population. But what's not true, or at least what does not appear to be true, either by genetics or drug trials, is that changing up HDL levels in either direction has an impact on risk. And so the assumption is that HDL is just sort of a innocent bystander, right? That it happens to be linked to something else that's moving up and down that is actually controlling the risk. And then that third one, the triglycerides that we talked about that I was taught to ignore, is now thought, although I think, you know, there's some controversy, but it's thought to itself confer risk, so that higher levels of circulating triglycerides do actually increase risk and lower levels don't. That's I think still a work in progress, but that one appears to be important. But
I see.
LDL cholesterol and specifically apolipoprotein B containing lipoproteins are still the bad actors.
I see. Okay, definitely I'll touch upon that. Before that, one question on HDL cholesterol, though. So, because there are quite a few cases of these, and in fact, I saw it in my blood test too. What happens if a person's LDL levels are low, triglycerides are low as well, but their HDL is low too? Is that concerning?
Well, you know, again, if you took a population, I'm not going to not answer your question, but if you took a population of people like you or, you know, that had that profile, yeah, the risk would be higher. The problem is it's not clear that doing things to raise HDL. So we know certain interventions can raise HDL. We know that exercise, for example, raises HDL. Exercise is good for you.
No questions about that.
There's no, you know, argument about that. But
yeah,
the impact of exercise on raising HDL doesn't appear to. Other things like drinking alcohol raises HDL. It's probably not going to make it. And then there are drugs that raise HDL. Those drugs have been tested again and again and again. And it doesn't appear they do anything to impact risk. And like I said, the genetic variation, so genes that vary the levels of HDL cholesterol also don't appear to, independent from these other things, also don't, it doesn't appear to impact risk. So it predicts risk, but it's not, that the conclusion is not, oh, well, let's get it higher to mitigate that risk.
Interesting. Okay, I see. So it's like, I guess you would typically see that people who have high levels of LDL probably have low levels of HDL, or is that not always the case?
Sorry, say you would typically see that people with
who have, say, higher levels of LDL, is that correlated to having low levels of HDL, or is that not the case?
Not necessarily. No, the two may be independent. I mean, their HDL and triglycerides tend to travel together, and they often are, you know, associated with insulin resistance. So you can see sort of low levels of HDL, high levels of triglycerides in patients with significant insulin resistance. That's true. But LDL and HDL are probably at least mostly independent.
Okay. Let's dive into LDL then, because you'd mentioned a couple of things. One is lipoprotein little a, ApoB. And also, I believe it's about, you know, the small, dense LDL particles maybe versus the large, fluffy ones. I know it's like quite a lot in there, maybe three different questions. Maybe, I guess, you started about talking about small, dense LDL versus the large, fluffy ones. Is that what we should be measuring versus just LDL cholesterol levels?
Sure. So that, you know, as is probably clear, right, LDL is not just one thing. LDL is a lot of things. And that's become more clear over the years. But back even in the 1980s, there was a group of researchers over at Berkeley led by Ron Krauss who found that there was this interesting association where if you fractionated LDL on a column or on a gel and you sort of could separate out the sort of smaller ones that travel faster down the gel or down the column from the higher ones, it looked like there was this sort of binary, relatively binary pattern where some people had a predominance of the small particles that, yes, are denser, and some people had more of the larger particles that were less dense, that are fluffier. And it looked like the people who had a predominance of the larger particles had less risk, and it looked like the people who had predominance of the smaller particles had higher risk. And so this was termed pattern A and pattern B. People had pattern A, which were the bigger ones, looked like they had less risk. This was published in a series of papers, and they were all really, really well done. And over the years, it took a while, people started to think, well, this is something we should measure clinically because it'll help guide us in terms of risk. And it's now become sort of part of a standard panel of advanced lipids that you can get from any of the commercial labs. And, you know, I think it's generally helpful in understanding risk. We haven't yet demonstrated the fulfillment of, if we were talking about microbiology, what Koch's postulates. In other words, we haven't shown that changing from pattern A to pattern B, which, by the way, you can do that with diet. There are dietary changes that can affect the relative sort of predominance of these two patterns. And but we haven't yet shown that that has an impact on risk. So it may just be, again, another association and not causative. That hasn't been demonstrated yet. So I think the clinical utility is sort of modest in terms of it helps, again, add to sort of prediction, right? If you're trying to get an overall sense of sort of what is this person in front of me, what is their risk of having a heart attack in, you know, 2, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, understanding this, you know, the size of their particles can be somewhat helpful. It's not, again, it doesn't mean that it's impossible that changing the pattern would be helpful. It might be. So I think many people will sort of say, well, what's the harm if I can make a dietary change that makes my, you know, numbers look better? Why not do that? So, but again, that hasn't been proven.
Okay. So what sort of dietary change would a person have to make?
Oh, it's almost all controlled by dietary carbohydrates. So it's a interesting thing that people were able to figure out, again, 30 something years ago, that people who ate a predominant, sort of a large intake of carbohydrates tended to have the smaller, denser particles. And if you reduced your carbohydrate intake, you could flip the pattern and make them look larger. So we can talk about that and the impact of carbohydrate restriction on other things and sort of how people have interpreted all of that, and if you want later on. But that's the major impact is from carbohydrate intake.
Okay. I mean, I think we can talk about that right now, and then we can talk about some of the other factors in LDL as well. What have you seen with carbohydrate restriction and just, or conversely, intake of too much carbohydrates and heart disease risk?
Well, unfortunately, we can't answer it in any real way, right? Because the study's never really been done. I think so obviously everybody who pays attention should understand that doing nutrition science is very difficult. It's not impossible, but it's difficult. It's difficult to do interventional prospective studies. We do a lot of epidemiology. Epidemiology is really difficult too, because it's kind of really hard to know exactly what people are eating. They're notoriously pretty bad at reporting it. So it's kind of what we have. There have been a few good interventional nutrition studies that look, at least in some loose way, like you'd expect a randomized clinical trial of a drug, and you know, they're powered, there are a lot of people, they last for a long time. You're always going to be stuck with how adherent are people to these diets. That the most famous of these studies was called the PREDIMED study, which was a study of the Mediterranean diet, and that study has been controversial because it ended up getting retracted. It got retracted for a reason that I think was, well, my opinion is that it really didn't change the impact or the conclusion of the study. But it was a really interesting study, the way they designed it. And they did something that is really useful in designing these kinds of interventional nutrition studies, which is that they measured markers of adherence. So this was a study where they really were testing not the Mediterranean diet per se, but the addition of olive oil and nuts to a diet. And so there was really three arms. People ate a conventional diet, people ate a Mediterranean diet plus olive oil, and people ate Mediterranean diet plus a lot of nuts. But they went and they were able to measure markers of sort of olive oil metabolism in the urine and the stool. So they were actually able to show that people were relatively adherent to these diets. That's sort of a nice trick to be able to do it. That study, again, it was a little bit misunderstood because it wasn't truly a study of the Mediterranean diet. It was really more of a study of olive oil and nuts. But that study was amazing in terms of its findings. It was the first, I think, major study to show a reduction in heart outcomes like heart attack and stroke, risk of diabetes and other things. So I think that's really one of a handful of studies that have been done in a truly rigorous way, where we can say, yeah, one diet is actually going to confer reduced cardiovascular risk. There aren't others.
Presumably people were replacing their carbohydrate consumption for more olive oil and nuts then.
In that study, it wasn't clear. I have to go back and look at the macros. Not sure exactly if they changed or how much they changed their total macronutrient consumption. I'm not sure if they actually ate fewer carbohydrates. maybe because they were having more fat. I mean, they were having a lot of olive oil. So nutrition is zero sum, right? If you're going to eat more of one thing, you're going to, by definition, eat less of something else. So it's very possible. There have been a lot of studies of low carbohydrate diets on different things like weight or markers of risk, but there haven't been studies, well done prospective studies, to look at the likelihood of a heart event, like a heart attack or a stroke. Again, it's just all changes in biomarkers. So we can't really say that carbohydrate restriction itself is going to reduce your risk of having a heart attack. It'll make the numbers look better in most cases. Now, in some cases, it doesn't, because there's this whole world of people who will restrict their carbohydrates, and then, yeah, their LDL particle size looks good, but their LDL itself goes very high, which, mm-hmm. We sort of talked about earlier is bad. I think there's debate in certain corners of the internet about how bad that is, or if it's bad at all. My opinion is there is no debate, right? It is bad. And if there's a world in which it's not bad, that world has not been demonstrated yet. So I think we as physicians are sort of intelligent thing to do is to assume that elevations in LDL cholesterol are bad in every context, which we've seen. So I think, there's a mix of effects when you, do something like change your diet and say replace a bunch of carbohydrate with a bunch of fat.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that if someone has high levels of LDL cholesterol, but still low number of these small dense LDL particles that you were talking about, that is still at risk?
Well, I'll be specific and formal about it. We don't know the risk formally. It's never been tested. But I think the assumption is by some people that if you'll offset that increase in total LDL cholesterol or apolipoprotein B by changing that pattern where you'll reduce your amount of small, dense LDL cholesterol and increase the amount. That's just never been shown to be true. I mean, that's just a hypothesis. And as with all hypotheses in science, it needs to be tested. So it hasn't been tested yet.
Okay. So going back to carbohydrates, maybe, it's funny because most people always assumed higher fats with cardiovascular risk and heart disease. And I mean, believe it or not, obviously it's strange, but I think to some extent, a lot of people will still hold on to that. Why do you think maybe carbohydrate restriction could help in preventing cardiovascular disease? Do you have any hypotheses about maybe anything that's happening with our blood sugar levels, insulin, et cetera, that could be protecting us from the risk of heart disease?
Right. Well, let me back up and say, yes, when I grew up in the 1970s and 80s, all fat was bad. That was probably a product of the McGovern Report, which came out in the late 1970s, which I think sort of made the mistake of lumping all fat together as being bad. And I think we have good evidence now. We just talked about the impact of monounsaturated fat in something like olive oil in the Predimet study. So we have good evidence that, while certain fats appear to be risky or at least cause changes that appear to confer risk, right? So increased intake of saturated fats, the kinds of things you'd find in, animal fat or butter, or lard, things like that, those tend to be bad. So I think the McGovern report probably could have said that Americans should limit their intake of saturated fat, but then we also know that the monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats are not only not bad, but they're actually good, right? So it's not just a sort of neutral. So in some ways, what we were doing was encouraging people to replace healthy foods, which are rich in monounsaturated fats, so foods like avocados or olives, olive oil, things like salmon, but replace those with carbohydrates, processed foods. So I do think that the guidance to limit total fat intake was off and probably wrong, and that we have good evidence to support that not all fat is bad fat. So I think that's fair. In terms of sort of what is the potential benefit of carbohydrate restriction on cardiovascular health, again, it hasn't really been tested, so it's kind of hard to say, but I can speculate that if you keep LDL cholesterol independent, right, if you're going to, again, my firm belief is that if you do something, whatever you do, and your LDL cholesterol goes sky high, that's bad. So if you restrict carbohydrates and your LDL cholesterol goes high. My belief is that's bad. If you restrict carbohydrates and your LDL cholesterol doesn't move, then yeah, you can start to explore other potential areas where you can make hypotheses that this would improve cardiovascular risk. And one of the things you mentioned would be insulin glucose. So it is true that if you go on a carbohydrate restricted diet, that your insulin levels will go down. And insulin has been shown to be associated with cardiovascular risk in large trials, and it's a growth factor, and it could potentially be something that would impact cardiovascular risk. So I think, you know, to me, that's the most intriguing. There are all other, you know, possible things, including inflammation, all the things we've talked about, or a series of things we haven't talked about. So.
Right. That's exactly what I was going to ask you about, inflammation. You said that, you know, that's one thing that's being studied a lot more now. So do you think that could be a possible connection here with restricting carbohydrates and inflammation going down and preventing cardiovascular risk?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we inflammation is another one of these things that sort of, again, relatively new, at least in sort of modern human history, as our understanding it, as it contributes to cardiovascular risk. And there have been now, you know, it's not just having low levels of circulating inflammatory markers is associated with lower risk. There have been studies that, you know, there was a study done with a drug that is an anti-inflammatory drug that did actually show a reduction in cardiovascular outcomes. Now, that drug had all kinds of other problems, so it's not going to be used clinically, but it was an interesting proof of concept that you could reduce inflammation with a drug that has nothing to do with cholesterol or any other, you know, sort of conventional cardiovascular risk factor. You could just reduce the inflammation and improve outcomes. So that was kind of interesting.
Fascinating. So, series of things that we haven't talked about. I believe some of it is probably to do with lipoproteins, lipoprotein little a, POB. Maybe before we actually talk about them, if you can explain the role of lipoproteins, what are they?
They're just exactly what they sound like. So they're proteins that carry around fats. So, you know, fats are very hydrophobic. So they actually need some carrier to be able to get in and out of the cell. So these lipoproteins are just proteins that wrap themselves around these lipid-laden sacs, basically, and they help traffic. So the most notorious of them is apolipoprotein B, which is on, stretching my knowledge here, I believe there's one apolipoprotein B on every molecule of LDL. Or every particle of LDL, and but it also happens to be on triglyceride particles as well as lipoprotein little a, which is a sort of cousin that sort of looks a little bit more like a coagulation factor in some ways, but it's got this lipidness to it as well, and it contains apolipoprotein B.
Okay, so yeah, let's talk about these two then. This APOB you said is. So most people are talking about how it's strongly associated with heart disease risk.
Yeah, I think the field has evolved, right, over the past 25 years, right? We've really focused on LDL cholesterol, despite the fact that it wasn't measured directly and it was kind of a noisy measurement. There are assays to allow you to measure LDL directly. Those assays are pretty good. In the epidemiology world, people found that LDL cholesterol itself was not the best predictor of risk, but actually it was non-HDL cholesterol, which is just the total cholesterol minus the HDL fraction, which effectively leaves the LDL and triglyceride fractions over, right? It's effectively the ApoB-containing lipoproteins. So that performs very well in large epidemiologic studies in predicting risk. And then if you want to be even more specific, you can actually measure apolipoprotein B directly using an assay. And that is a relatively recent development over the past, you know, 15, 20 years that you can do that. It's become quite common now and actually quite affordable. The argument before was, oh, it's too expensive. It's actually not very expensive. So I think the, you know, current state of affairs is that ApoB, in my opinion, is the most direct and accurate predictor of risk. And so that's what I use as a gold standard in people, and that's kind of what I've moved to following in my patients. It's just is apolipoprotein B. Lipoprotein little a is a little bit different. It's mostly controlled by genetics, and so it does vary somewhat with lifestyle, but not nearly to the degree that the other lipids do. So it's really a one-time test, right, where you look to see if it's super elevated. We've seen in the past, 15, 20 years, that there is a strong association between people who have significant elevations in lipoprotein little a and risk of disease. It's particularly sort of apparent in younger people. And so I think there were a number of studies, and then the popular press got caught wind of this and wrote their articles, in the New York Times about people with significant elevations in LP little a who had heart attacks in their 30s and 40s. And so again, because of the familial and genetic nature, these events tended to run in families. So when you see somebody with advanced atherosclerotic coronary disease at a young age and it runs in the family, that would be sort of one of the first things you'd think about. You'd obviously also think about FH, conventional elevations in ApoB as well.
So most of that is genetic, though, lipoprotein A?
Yeah. Most of the variation is genetic. There are, I think, anecdotes of people being able to move LP little a in some directions, modestly with diet or exercise. But to me, it's kind of, you're kind of born with a set point, and that's what it is, and it doesn't change. Now, there are multiple drug companies who are trying to develop drugs that will lower LP little a, because it's been so strongly associated with risk, both, again, both epidemiologically, but also by genetics. So we know that human genetics now has sort of contributed to the literature that if you have variations in LP, significant variations in LP little a, where it's very high or potentially very low, that does impact risk.
Do statins work towards lowering LP little a or ApoB?
Great question. No, they don't. And in some cases, they can even increase it modestly. PCSK9 inhibitors, which are sort of the latest version of cholesterol-lowering, well, not the latest, but a recent development of cholesterol-lowering drugs that are very potent cholesterol-lowering drugs that work through a related pathway to the pathway that statins work in, they do modestly reduce LP little a by, on average, about 30% in a population of people. It's not clear yet whether that reduction also reduces risk, right? That experiment hasn't been done. There have been some sort of ways to get at trying to make a guess that maybe it's beneficial. So if you took people who were in a trial that involved a PCSK9 inhibitor and you looked at people who had high levels of LP little a at baseline that they came down, you can sort of begin to piece together, well, did those people do better than the people who didn't have high LP little a at baseline, or people who had high LP little a and it didn't come down yet? So that's the latest on that one.
Interesting. Okay. So what about ApoB? Do these drugs work towards lowering that?
They all work to lower ApoB. So all four now of the approved classes of medications to lower what we would call LDL cholesterol also lower ApoB. And those include statins, so HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors, which everybody thinks they work through a mechanism of reducing cholesterol synthesis. And actually, turns out they really work predominantly. So they do reduce cholesterol synthesis because they inhibit an enzyme that's necessary to synthesize cholesterol. That happens mostly in liver cells and hepatocytes. But what happens then is the liver cell senses that it's got a deficiency of cholesterol. And so it upregulates the LDL receptor, which sits on the surface of the cell, which grabs a bunch of LDL out of the circulation and pulls it in, clears it, and gets rid of it. And so it's really that mechanism that we think is important in the sort of benefit of statins, both in terms of reducing LDL cholesterol, but also in terms of reducing risk. So statins, we talked about PCSK9 inhibitors. Those medicines actually work to inhibit this enzyme PCSK9, which normally eats up the LDL receptor. So it's a similar pathway. There's a medicine called ezetimibe or Zetia, which has been around for almost 20 years. And that medicine impacts an enzyme. It's actually not an enzyme. It's a transporter that sits on the inside of the intestine that is involved in absorption of cholesterol from food. That molecule is called NPC-1L1. And so Zetia blocks that. And then there's a fourth agent. And sorry, all three of those drugs have been tested in large prospective randomized trials. And all three have been shown to reduce risk to different degrees of heart attack. The fourth one is called bempedoic acid, which is the most recent arriver to the market. That one's approved now. It will lower LDL cholesterol. It has not yet been demonstrated to reduce risk in a large prospective trial.
Okay. ApoB, want to talk a little bit about that. I'm curious about the history, as in how did people come to realize maybe that's the marker that is more predictive of heart disease? I guess, I know you mentioned it's like, I guess, binds to the lipoprotein. Maybe I'm butchering that. But what is the role it plays, or what is going on that it's such a good predictor of heart disease?
Well, it, like I said, it's on every LDL particle. It's on every triglyceride particle. Basically, any particle that has an ApoB molecule is probably bad. And that was worked out both at the bench in sort of scientific experiments, but it was then also worked out with epidemiology. We've been looking for ways to predict risk forever. The first major effort was that Framingham study that happened in the 1950s in Massachusetts, and that that one was the one that identified sort of the constellation of traditional cardiovascular risk factors that we all know about. Since then, people have been looking to do better, and they've been measuring everything you can think of. And the truth is that most markers don't really improve risk prediction. We've swung and missed a lot, but a few of them do. And like I said, non-HDL cholesterol, just taking total cholesterol minus the HDL, is actually a better predictor of risk than LDL. It's modest and probably not meaningfully so. So people are used to thinking about LDL. They're used to thinking about the numbers. That one never really caught on. But ApoB is maybe even a notch better. It's really the most direct measurement of risk, and it's the best performing in large studies. It's not like 10 times better. It's maybe not even 2 times better, but it's better and it's direct. And so for that reason, I think it's going to supplant LDL eventually is sort of the thing that we look at as the primary driver, sort of cholesterol-related driver of risk.
Okay. What about triglycerides? I know you said they're also increasingly becoming very important to look at. Are they just straight up related to fat consumption or fat floating around in your body? How did they get elevated?
Well, they can come from two sources, right? They can come from something that you eat. So we absorb fat from our meals, and they come in the form of what are called chylomicrons. And those can then float around and go to different places. And then we also have the capacity to make new fat. The liver is the predominant organ that does that. And that traffics around as well. Triglyceride molecules, the concentration of triglyceride in the blood actually is mostly probably related, again, to genetics, but then there are some lifestyle things that make an impact, or not just lifestyle, but sort of disease-related things. So insulin resistance is, I think, the most prominent of those, that we know that insulin is important in regulating transport of fat around the body, and people who are insulin resistant tend to have higher levels of circulating triglycerides. Again, is the risk the increased triglycerides? Is it insulin resistance? We don't know specifically, but we do know that the variation in genes that cause changes in a positive and negative direction of triglyceride concentration in the blood do confer risk. It's not nearly as powerful as the impact of genetic variation of LDL cholesterol, but there is an impact. And again, if you compare it to HDL, where there's no impact, it sort of points out that triglycerides themselves probably do confer risk. The question, I think, is how much of that is due to the ApoB, right? Because there's an ApoB wrapped around a lot of these triglyceride particles, and how much of that is something else. It's not settled yet, and we're still working on trying to understand it, but I think for the most part, we do try to lower triglycerides. Now, there are certain conditions where triglycerides are extremely elevated, sort of way above normal. And those can be associated with other problems, including a significant risk of pancreatitis. And there are people who are born with rare genetic conditions that confer these very high levels of triglycerides. And again, those patients can have a very high risk of having pancreatitis. Some of those patients have very high risk of having coronary disease, some don't. They're relatively rare diseases. It's kind of hard to piece out exactly how it works. But
So there could also be a case where person has low levels or normal levels of ApoB, but still high triglycerides, and that could be telling.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there could be cases. Yeah.
Okay. One thing I know you'd mentioned saturated fat, and there's also debate on, you know, saturated fat is not bad for you. You know, even like say butter or ghee, it's fine. Say maybe if you're not eating too much processed carbohydrates, what's your take on that?
I mean, I guess my take is it's all complicated.
I know all of nutrition science, I feel like is also so personal. And as you said, there are no rule studies that can be done.
It's really personal. I think, look, here's what I would say is, we know that the stupid thing that you always hear is, you know, anything in moderation is probably fine. I think it's probably true. Anything in moderation is probably fine. Do I eat meat from time to time? Yeah. Do I eat saturated fat from time to time? I do. Yeah. Do I eat a lot of it? No. And we know, as we talked about before, that eating high level or lots of saturated fat will increase your LDL cholesterol. And every line of evidence I've ever looked at suggests that that will increase your risk of having that coronary artery disease or vascular disease. So I don't suggest people do it for that reason. Now, if you are one of the lucky people where you can eat a lot of saturated fat and your cholesterol doesn't go up, can I tell you, you know, that that's bad? No. Do I suspect it's bad? Yeah, but I can't tell you that it's bad. So again, my opinion is, and it's just my opinion, and I think it's, you know, probably consistent with most mainstream cardiologists, is that high levels of intake of saturated fat are not bad. And when I'm talking about high, I'm talking about like really, you know, high.
Are not good, you mean, sorry.
Hmm?
High levels of saturated fat are not good.
Not good.
I think you mentioned are not bad. Yeah, okay.
So I think this like idea that you ought to be putting butter in your coffee is kind of like lunacy. I don't know where that came from. So if you want to, you know, fry an egg in a little bit of butter, in a tablespoon of butter, and do that from time to time, is that going to kill you? No, probably not. I mean, there are a lot of things that can kill you. So again, it's all about sort of being reasonable and moderate and in an approach. And so I think that people who go to extremes in diets for not religious or cultural reasons, but just because they think it's healthy, I think it's probably not the greatest way to live. Again, it's personal, it's their choice, and they can do what they want, but that's not, you know, sort of not the way I do things.
Right. How stable are these levels of cholesterol when we're getting them tested? And I guess I was looking at, you know, Peter Attia had this post and he had different charts where he measured his LDL, HDL cholesterol levels and then particle size, like say the morning when he woke up right after exercise and 4 hours post exercise. And it seemed to vary a lot. So if someone's getting a blood test, then how do you tell, I guess, if it's a stable level or if I just took it after exercise, oh, I have great LDL levels, but maybe in the morning they're a lot more elevated.
Yeah, it's a good question, and they are very variable, and they have a lot to do with, you know, time of day and, you know, the sort of how close you are to having exercise, but also what you ate the night before, how long you fasted, you know, all that stuff. It makes a huge impact. I think, you know, I try to guide my patients to do things relatively consistently. So again, what we're looking at are trends for the most part. So if you typically, you know, go to the lab to get your blood drawn in the morning after you've, you know, fasted overnight, and sort of try to keep things relatively consistent in terms of your routine. The truth is it's, you know, it's part of the normal variation of biology. And I think that sometimes is upsetting to people that biology is that variable, but it is. And so it's an imperfect world we live in, and we'll do the best with the information that we have. So, I can't tell you if it's like best to measure it before or after exercise or after, you know, I think for the most part, if you go to the lab in the morning and you're fasted, and fasting for lipids is not required anymore, but it is if you want to measure triglycerides. And in general, like I said, I try to do that from now on, for, you know, from today.
No, I'm always fascinated by this variation, especially because at least people should have that information. And I know it's like, you know, when biological age tests, for example, are so popular now, but a lot of studies are like, oh, people get it tested, say right after exercise or after just supplementing with a particular thing. And it's like, you shed 8 years of your biological age. I was like, well, I'm not really sure if that's true, but that's why it's like, I was wondering what, like how much the timing of their variation mattered.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to dive in on the biological age thing, but it definitely, things vary. I mean, I saw somebody the other day who had brought a bunch of blood tests with him to the office, and he had his blood drawn at the same time. And somehow, I don't exactly understand why, they sent it off to two different places to measure the same thing. And there was, you know, it wasn't a huge amount of variation, but there was definitely some variation between the assay. So even the assay itself has some variation. So if you took the same blood and ran it on the same assay, you probably see some level of variation for a lot of these things.
Wow.
Actually, okay. Built into these assays, they have what's called a coefficient of variation. So they're allowed to vary within some number.
I see. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about ketogenic diets and stuff. But before that, are there any other maybe emerging markers that are appearing for testing cardiovascular risk? Or I know you'd mentioned that, you know, there are a series of things we have discussed, or maybe you haven't discussed anything we haven't touched upon when it relates to just screenings or checks or markers.
I think the one that's probably going to be the most important in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years that is not being used routinely in clinical practice now is body composition. I think we've focused a lot of attention in the past 50 years on weight or body mass. And, you know, there's clearly some relationship there, but it's pretty messy. And just like we know that there are some good fats and some bad fats that you put in your body, not all fat that we carry on our body is bad. In fact, some of it is probably quite good. So there is, you know, sort of emerging evidence over the past 20 years that people who carry more fat in their belly tend to have a higher risk of bad outcomes, including diabetes and coronary disease, whereas people who carry more fat on their hips and their legs tend to have a decreased risk, right? It's not just neutral. It's not just an absence of more abdominal or what we call visceral fat, the fat around the organs. It's that there's a protection afforded by the fat that we don't understand why, but people have more fat down in the hips and legs. So it goes back to this, you know, sort of apple pear descriptor that people have used for some time. And, you know, women, particularly younger women, tend to be more pear-shaped and men tend to be more apple-shaped. That I think will be something that in the next, you know, 5 years will become a part of routine risk assessment. It's done now in specialized places, and people, you know, people like Peter, who, you know, his patients spend a lot of money to come see him, he'll use body composition testing. There's also an impact of sort of lean muscle mass, right, or lean mass, right, that is important. So I think we'll get better and better at sort of appreciating the importance of body composition.
100%. So I'm curious, when it comes to men versus women, for example, men in general tend to carry more body fat on their bellies, which, as you mentioned, and there have been a couple of studies on this as well, that it is, I guess, worse kind of fat than carrying fat around your hips or bellies, which women tend to typically do. But are there differences in terms of risk for men versus women in where they're carrying their fat? I guess what I mean is, like, men typically carry their fat around their belly. So is it still worse off for them, or maybe there's a different way to think about men versus women in terms of body composition?
Well, I think I understand your question, but yeah, so there is definitely a sex dimorphism or sex difference in body composition, right? So if you took an average man and an average woman, they would look different, particularly premenopausal, right? So women after menopause tend to actually look a little bit more like men in terms of the body composition. But just if you take an average 40-year-old man and woman, they will look different, right? A man will be a little bit more apple-shaped and a woman would be a little bit more pear-shaped. And within those group, within men and women, there are people who, you know, don't fit the pattern, the sex-based pattern. There are men who tend to have relatively more hip fat and leg fat and less belly fat, and there are women who tend to have more abdominal fat and visceral fat and less leg fat, those people have the risk associated with the body composition. So it's not really just the sex. It's really probably more about the body composition that's driving the risk. And we know that there's, again, human genetics has taught us a lot here. There are variation in genes that have been identified that confer these different body types that are also very strongly associated with risk. So it's another sort of thing to point to.
100%. No, I think South Asians, Indians definitely actually tend to carry more fat on their bellies as opposed to, say, hips or thighs, for example.
Yeah, that's a well-recognized phenomenon. And in fact, the sort of normal BMI for South Asians is lower than it is for people, say, from North America. A normal BMI here, you're considered to be normal weight if you're below 25, overweight if you're 25 to 30, and obese if you're above 30. I think for South Asians, that's 23 is the cutoff. And the reason for that is that, again, if you're just looking at the total amount of fat you're missing. Now, if you correct for the distribution of fat, you probably account for a lot of the differences in risk.
I see. Okay. Fascinating. Yeah, I do hope a lot of that starts being incorporated, because it is definitely very telling, just muscle mass and fat composition. Yeah. All right, cool. I want to talk about a little bit about low carb and ketogenic diets, because I know you definitely changed your mind on them and you have a personal experience with them. And we also spoke a little bit about, you know, how maybe incorporating more healthy fats or restricting some carbohydrates can, in fact, lead to lesser risk of cardiovascular disease potentially. What is your story with ketogenic diets? Is this something maybe you'd recommend everyone try it out, or is it not for everyone? And why is that the case?
Well, it's definitely not for everyone, because not everyone wants to do it. And
yeah.
I think, you know, it's probably, I mean, carbohydrates are everywhere, and they're also really tasty. And I think, again, we were all sort of conditioned to eat them thinking that they were heart healthy. I don't want to say that they're not. I think we don't have evidence to say that they're not. I happened to find this diet, and it worked really well for me, and I like eating that way. And it's not that I never eat carbohydrates. I do. I'll go out and have sushi with my family, and, you know, I'll go to the movies and have popcorn. I mean, I definitely am not, you know, super restrictive in terms of what I eat, but I generally try to eat mostly plants, you know, mostly vegetables, mostly fish, and, you know, occasionally some other, you know, meats. And then I use a lot of foods that are, I eat a lot of foods that are high in unsaturated fats. Like I said, you know, avocados, and I use a lot of olive oil and salmon we talked about. So I haven't measured my ketones in a long time. I would imagine I'm still probably modestly in ketosis. It depends probably a little bit on what day of the week and what it was that I ate earlier. But I think, again, for 4 years now, I've been doing this and I kind of like it. My kids make fun of me, but I like it. And again, I find places to have carbohydrates. Like, I like to drink wine. There's, you know, about 4 or 5 grams of carbohydrate in a glass of wine. So I just choose to have my carbohydrates in, I choose to have less of them, and I choose to have them in the ways that I like them. So,
yeah, I started doing it also about 2 years ago, and I really like it. It just gave me such high levels of mental clarity. I never had any of those slumps post meals. And I think the best thing is, like, I also just cleaned up my diet in the process, like, you know, eating a lot more, say, avocados or olive oil or just healthy nuts. And I haven't gotten off of it. I'm similar to you, where obviously, like, sometimes I'll add in more carbohydrates, especially because if I'm exercising, say, I might add a little more beans or something like that in my diet, or berries. And I try to eat a lot more vegetables, which I guess in the conventional way might put you out of ketosis, depending on how you measure it. I don't really measure ketones, but I'm like, I'm going to eat my cruciferous vegetables because I know they're good. I'm exercising a lot too. And I don't know, I really like it. My friends also make fun of me, but I really enjoy it.
I think that's the key, right? I mean, it's I think you said something a minute ago that to me is the most important thing, which is that you said you cleaned up your diet, and that's exactly what I think happened to me as well. You know, I lost like 25 pounds when I started doing this, and felt better and had all the other, you know, changes that were good. But I think the biggest change was that I cleaned up my diet, and you know, you can really make that clear when you think about lunch. So if I go to work and I'm going to not bring my lunch, which I didn't do forever until 4 years ago, I'll go out and grab lunch. So what does that mean? It means I'm going to go and get a sandwich or a sub, or I'm going to go to a food truck and get a burrito or, you know, whatever it is. But almost everything that you would eat at lunch in a work environment is going to have a lot of carbohydrates. So
right.
I think the biggest change that I made when I started eating this way was that I stopped eating out for lunch. I started bringing my lunch to work and I brought a salad every day. And yeah, my kids make fun of me about that too, because my salad is basically pretty much almost identical every day, but I love it. And so I think that's like one of the biggest impacts, is that I make more food on a weekly basis. More of the meals that I consume are things that I make myself or somebody in my house makes, which I think if you could make one change in the world, that probably would be the most important thing, is that if we would stop eating food that other people put in front of us, we might actually be more aware and interested in sort of what's in it.
I couldn't agree more. I recently actually wrote a post on just what I eat. And I think one of my big things was, you know, maybe eating healthy is not going to make you live to 100 or whatever it is, but it just makes you feel so much better on a day-to-day basis that why don't you want your everyday to be much better than it can be right now? And that's what I love about it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So you even started a company, I think Keto, which is breath analyzer around this. I'm curious, why did you decide to start this? What is the product?
Yeah. So, you know, I started it basically because at the time, and I still believe this, I think one of the things that was interesting about a ketogenic diet was that unlike any other diet, it affords you a way to be able to measure if you're doing it correctly, if you wanted to measure your ketones. And so we thought that there was a benefit to sort of from a behavioral standpoint to be able to reinforce these changes. And, you know, if you went out to eat and you had a salad and the salad happened to have a lot of sugar in it, you would never know that. But if you, you know, were measuring your ketones, you'd see that you were out of ketosis. So we thought it was helpful from a behavioral standpoint. And we ended up doing a randomized trial testing it, really testing the intervention, which is a, you know, sort of guide to how to eat paired with the breath analyzer. And we did that against Weight Watchers, like another, you know, commercial weight loss. And it was really amazing, the difference in the outcomes. It was actually, we didn't do the study. It was done by a really hotshot nutrition scientist up in British Columbia. And it was a cool result. And so, you know, I think it works. I think the issue is with everything else that people have a hard time staying on it, right? Like people like you and me who've done this for a long time are really outliers and unusual. And
yeah.
I think the gravitational pull back is strong. The one thing I'll say is I think the world has changed, right? I was just thinking about it the other day that just even the branding around soft drinks is different than it used to be. So, you know, when I was growing up, you had, you know, Diet Coke, and now, and then it became Coke Zero, and now it's Coke Zero Sugar. And so I think there's a sort of, and actually it's not just Coke, it's, you know, Canada Dry and a lot of other, they're actively marketing zero sugar, which I think tells you that there's an awareness around sort of the potential that added sugar is not great for you. And so there, I think that's, and you know, if you walk into a supermarket, almost anywhere in the US at least, you'll find, I think, healthy, relatively low carb options. It would be almost impossible to find that 5 years ago. And so I think as we move further along, it may not be quite as hard, right? You can go out to dinner, and obviously if you're not going to a pizza place, if you're going to a pizza place, you're going to have a hard time. I mean, maybe someday there will be some, you know, relatively decent tasting cauliflower pizza crust. But in general, you always find some way to eat. Like, again, it's not that hard. If you went out and you were going to have a protein, and the protein normally came with potatoes, it wouldn't be challenging in most places to say, could you replace the potatoes with some sauteed vegetables or even a side salad? Right? That's like a very simple thing. I think lunch is the hardest thing because we in this country are so obsessed with sandwiches. So, and you know, they're good and they're easy and you can hold them in your hand and you can walk with it and you can drive with it. That's hard, right? Like it's hard to eat a salad when you're driving a car. So traveling is still very hard. I think that's the like one area where I struggle the most. So, I mean, I think the company's doing fine, you know, it's trying, you know, the idea is to try and make this simple for people who are interested, who've heard about it and don't know how to do it. I think for somebody like you or me, you know, you don't need anything at, you know, at this point after 4 years, it's pretty easy to kind of eat that way. But for other people, it's not so easy.
Yeah, no, I'm glad. I mean, whatever makes it easier for people, if they want to try it out, obviously, right. And stick to it. And the thing about, I mean, sandwiches and brands, you said a lot more health awareness, consciousness for sure, which is very good. Bread, for example, I think there are lots of low carb options now, which are mainly made out of, say, almond flour or nuts or flax seeds, etc. So a lot more of those options coming out, at least in the US, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, I think that's the, it is interesting and exciting. I tend to like not eat. I started when I first started eating this way, I would eat all these sort of like keto friendly versions.
Keto products, right? Yeah.
I sort of don't do that anymore just because I think mostly I just like simple food. Like I don't think, you know, it's about, I don't know, it sort of sometimes feels like it's a little bit more artificial, especially the desserts. Yeah. Like that sort of. Whether someday there will be like a decent tasting keto pasta that like I would like, I don't know. Who knows?
All right. Last couple of questions.
Yeah.
What's the role of stress in heart disease? Now, in general, just I feel like everyone seems to be stressed all the time. How important do you think it is? Should people be measuring, say, cortisol levels when you're testing a patient who's coming in?
So I'll answer the first question first, or the last question first, which is I don't ever measure cortisol levels unless I think somebody's got Cushing's disease, but no, I don't think so. So, I mean, look, stress is like everything else that we learned from epidemiology. We learned from really interesting epidemiological studies that stress is associated with risk. You can see that even in there have been some studies looking at sort of what happens to the risk of heart attack in places after an earthquake or a natural disaster, or what happens to the risk of heart attack after a town loses a World Cup soccer game, right? Like these are it's kind of silly, but these are like natural experiments in nature. And they've shown that there is definitely an association between stress and cardiovascular disease that's been known for a long time. The sort of type A personality, right? That was associated with sort of like pattern A, the opposite in this case, I guess, that was associated with increased risk. I guess our world is pretty stressful, right? I mean, it's, in some ways, I think it's even more stressful now because we spend more time online, which is unfiltered, and less time outside and exercising and doing things that's probably more restorative. So I think we're all pretty stressed. I guess the one thing I would say is I see a lot of people who stress about stress. And and I think, you know, it's a little bit like sleep, right? You believe that you're stressed, and so then you're stressing about the fact that you're overstressed. And there's a whole, you know, industry of things that have come on, you know, like these apps to help you meditate and things that are going to help us, you know, at least try to moderate our stress. I think the secrets are actually not that complicated, right? Just go out and garden or cook or exercise,
right?
Walk or walk your dog, you know, all the stuff that I think we all know is good. One thing I've done is when I go out to exercise now, I don't take this thing with me. Like I try to leave it alone at home and just go out. So I do think stress is a problem. I think our world is stressed. I think the things that we can do to moderate or mitigate that stress are probably not that complicated, right? Like probably stay off the computer, stay off of Twitter and Facebook and, you know, read more and exercise more and cook more. And, yeah. Spend more time with your kid.
100%. I love it. You've mentioned a bit about just growth hormone. I know in Peter Attia's podcast, you really dove into it and the connection between heart disease and cardiovascular risk. Maybe if you can just touch a bit about that.
Well, I mean, I think growth hormone is pretty interesting. It was actually the first recombinant medicine that was made, you know, sort of in the modern era. People have growth hormone deficiency. I mean, we could talk about growth hormone forever, but for me, it's very closely related to insulin. So the two hormones evolve together. Growth hormone only exists in advanced animals. There's no growth hormone in animals before mammals. So, they tend to regulate each other. So insulin regulates growth hormone, and growth hormone regulates insulin. And we know that excess growth hormone causes insulin resistance. That's been known for over 100 years. And so we were interested in how that happens mechanistically. And, you know, I think are very interested in sort of whether that plays a role in cardiovascular risk. It has not, none of that's been demonstrated. We know that people who have tumors that secrete large amounts of growth hormone, a disease that's called acromegaly, a very increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And we also know that people who don't have enough growth hormone can have a, you know, impaired metabolism and risk of disease as well. So it's a pretty interesting field. I think learning a lot. So
I'm curious, mechanistically, what is happening then? Like the connection between growth hormone and insulin?
Well, we don't really know. I think the simplest way to think about it is that at least in the adipocyte, the fat cell, which is the cell that we think is the most important when it comes to these interactions between these two hormone systems, it looks like growth hormone acts as a brake on insulin signaling. So that, and we don't understand the exact molecular mechanism, but the growth hormone sort of is there to mute insulin signaling. It sort of makes sense in some ways. And so when growth hormone goes away, you relieve that brake and insulin is able to then signal normally. So people with very excess levels of growth hormone, basically they're blocking the action of insulin in the fat cell, which then causes all kinds of metabolic disturbances. So that's the basic model.
So is this something you test for as well in a person who maybe has...
No, not really, no. Not yet. It's, you know, it's not, we're not at that level yet. I think we do test for insulin resistance. I don't think we do it very well, but we can test for insulin resistance. I think if you were, you know, suspicious that somebody had acromegaly, you might gain suspicion based on the presence of insulin resistance and then other things that would suggest acromegaly. But acromegaly is a pretty rare disease, and so most physicians aren't making that diagnosis.
Fantastic. All right. So we've covered a lot. I want to just end with maybe talking a bit about what we can learn from your daughter. I know she was born with a genetic disease, but she still seems, at least from the post you wrote, very optimistic and maybe even more vibrant towards life, you know, and I think it's like, I mean, I won't call it a near-death experience, but I think when people have like death of a loved one in the family or near-death experience, they just realize that, wow, life has so much more meaning. I should be actually living each day more fully. So yeah, I'll let you talk about your daughter.
I don't know what to tell you. I mean, she's a pretty remarkable kid, and she's now 15, and we have no idea if she, I mean, it's really interesting to think about what she would be like if she had normal vision and didn't have this condition. We'll never know that. I think it's probably a mix. I think it's probably somewhat that she just was sort of naturally one of these people who like saw no obstacle that she didn't want to try to overcome, like just never really says no, always wants to challenge and push herself, wants to get the most out of life. I think having this difference and this disability has probably only reinforced that in her. I mean, she loves the fact that she, you know, can do as much or more than her normally sighted friends and classmates. I mean, I'll brag on her a little bit, and I brag on her too, but you know, it's easy to brag on Ruthie. I mean, Ruthie this year is a freshman in high school. She played basketball on the varsity basketball team in her high school.
Wow.
And you know, she's been playing basketball for a lot of her life, and she's pretty good at it. And she ended up having a good season. She made the at least honorable mention for the all conference team, which is pretty amazing. She was the only kid on her team to make it. And The fun thing is, I don't think people even know about her vision. Like it's like her teammates know about it because they have to make accommodations for her, right? So she can't read numbers on a jersey. They can't say guard number 23. They have to say guard the girl with the, you know, long blonde hair or with the pink shoes, or she can't read the clock. She can't read the shot clock. She often can't tell if when she shoots the basketball, if it goes in the net. So she has, you know, people around her who help her succeed, but she's pretty awesome.
That definitely sounds awesome.
She's definitely the kind of person that, well, I shouldn't speak for others, but I like to be around her. Actually, I like to be around both my kids, but I think that says a lot, right? Like she's the kind of person, she's entertaining, she's funny, she's self-deprecating, but she's so.
I love it. All right, is there anything else maybe we haven't covered and you want to talk about?
I don't think so. I think we've sort of hit on the major things. It's good. It's been fun.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Of course, my pleasure. It's been super fun. Thank you for having me.
Hi again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. I'm blown away by the pace of longevity research, and I want to keep bringing you great conversations with longevity scientists themselves. If you want to support the creation of the podcast, consider sharing it, leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, or signing up to be a premium member and receive transcripts. You can also donate on Patreon, which is patreon.com/livelongerworld, and connect with me on Twitter, where my handle is livelongerworld. Lastly, all information and resources can be found at livelongerworld.com. I want to leave you with a last thought, and that is, aging is universal. We can unite in this fight and be healthy forever. I can't wait, and see you next time.